This is a Gathering Heritage project interview recorded in County Louth in Ireland.
Now, I'm delighted to welcome to the Gathering Heritage project Conor Hughes. Now, we're not going to talk about Conor and all his charities that he does today. We're going to talk about his dad, and everyone knows him, of course, knew him, of course, Danny. And I suppose, Conor, you look back now at your dad's life, and he lived life to the full, didn't he?
Yeah, he had an extraordinary life. And he had a great way of looking at life, and I think that's what got him through even rough times. There's a few characteristics about my father. He never saw the bad in people. He wasn't naive, but he never saw the bad. He looked for the good. He loved work because work brought him in contact with people, and he very much enjoyed people. So he had hard times getting reared and so on, working early, and he not nostalgically looks back on that as good times. He actually knew they were good times because he.
Tell me a little bit about him. Where did he live? Where was he born? And a little bit about him.
He was born in Armagh, and they had a fruit shop, a quite forward-thinking fruit shop at the time. Then they fell on bad times and they moved to a meet. That was kind of the lowest ebb of the family. That's where he then came to the fore, because at 14 he had to leave school to start rearing the family. And that's where his initiative came. He would start buying and selling vegetables and hawking around Dundalk in particular. That's where lots of people would have remembered him, at the square or door to door.
And at that time, it was only the one thing he was doing was the vegetables.
At the very start, yes, it was the vegetables. Then when he started gathering his business ability, his horse and cart in the summer would be an ice cream cart. No, I'm sorry, a vegetable cart in the morning, transformed to an ice cream cart in the afternoon. And in the evening, then he played in the band. So he had these three sticks.
Was this all in Dundalk?
This was all local, yeah. Yeah, and like lots of people come in and remember him fondly for one of them criterias, you know, either the vegetables or the ice cream, because they'd tell me about maybe I'm trying to think of somebody. Yeah, he used to shout "ice cream, a condenser, a milk at a," because he always thought being slightly Italian would help business, and. I guess it's kind of, it's not an urban myth, but there was a time when he was cutting the ice cream, he hadn't got his knife, and he bought a knife, and it was a two-sided knife, which he didn't realise, and he cut his hand, and he said, just as I was about to pack up with blood everywhere, one woman shouted to everybody, this man's got strawberry in his ice cream, and he says, I sold the lot, I hadn't an inch of blood in my body, I was white pale, but I was delighted with my sales.
Yeah. Oh dear God!
So these are all the stories I was reared on.
Yeah, and I suppose Conor, you can look back on his life, like, you know, with great admiration for him. The ideas that he had way back when he was very young man.
Yeah, he was forward thinking, and Dad travelled a bit. You know, it was always a problem them days. If you didn't travel, you were a wee bit held back in your ambition and what you thought you could get out of life. So,
do you mean going on holidays?
Yeah, he'd go to Blackpool and he'd come back with loads of ideas from Blackpool, you know.
Oh yeah, he'd be right up his street, wasn't it, Blackpool?
Oh, so he lived and breathed when the shop would close after the busy summer. We'd pack up and go to Blackpool.
Have you good memories of Blackpool?
Well, we have, because one of course the big thing he'd always buy rock for the year from Blackpool, and the big selling point of air rock was that it had black rock on it, but it was actually Blackpool. But Dad used to put his hand over the word pool when he'd sell it, and he'd have it into the bag as quick as you like, but the rocks were going 50 miles to Belfast or someone, so that was the end of it.
So he was even doing it when he was on holidays.
Oh yeah, no, that was. He loved business, and it was the sociality of the shop that I guess made him well known. People, You know, they knew when they'd come in here there was a chat to be had, there was a story. It wasn't a barcode shop. You know?
Well, tell me a little bit about the music. I didn't realise until I was looking up about him, mm-hmm. about the music. What kind of music did he play?
Yeah, he played the violin, and he was smart enough. He said, I wasn't the best violin player, but I was great at organising the band. I'm somewhat like that myself. And he'd always surround himself with good musicians. And
these were a Cayley band, was it?
Cayley band, stroke dance band. Like, for example, one time he answered an ad in one of the Mayo papers. They're having a week-long festival and they wanted seven bands. And Dad, he wrote to them seven letters from seven different bands. The Nightingale Dance Band, the Rosewood Country Band, the Spring Cayley Band. But Jingo, didn't he get all seven nights? Much to his astonishment, he thought he'd get one. Well, he says, by the last night, he says, the fellow who was running the whole thing was a sergeant. He threw his coat on the ground and said, I'm going to kill you all. He had to be held back because he needed them every night when they'd land. They'd land the same guys again. So who are you? We're the Nightingale Dance Band. He said it was a huge memory.
Did when you say the Cayley, did he do Cayley's like in the Gaelic League Hall, that kind of stuff?
I guess so. And then he knew that those dance bands were also needed, so he had a slightly different format for that, you know.
And he was kind of Italian-y looking anyway, wasn't he? And I'd say when he was all dressed up on the stage, he was a fine looking man.
Yeah, he prayed a bit on that, definitely selling the ice cream. And you know the look he had. He was fine looking. He had real good hair, and you know he was popular.
Was he a ladies' man in the band? Because he always struck me as a fella that was very confident in the.
I guess so. I didn't know him as that, but the little bits he would trickle out from that. Funny, we're never sort of a show-off about the many ladies he knew or anything, but he used to always tell me, he always made one rule every night. He would spot the girl that had no dance, didn't get a dance, and he would dance her. This was just a thing he'd do, apparently. Yeah, that's what I can tell you. But funny, I don't know the ladies' aspect, but I know the ladies' aspect from the shop, because being so sweet to ladies in the shop really helped sales. And so he'd be getting letters and, you know, people coming back to fulfil promises, perhaps. And that was all for sales, really, yeah.
Yeah, because it's incredible that there's very few people that, the minute you mention Danny Hughes, you can mention all the different things he did, because everyone, he had so many people involved during his life.
Yeah.
He was a very popular man, wasn't he?
I guess he was popular. This shop was, you know, now even, Harry, people come in and have such fond memories of it. Like, definitely, like in July there, just gone by, lots of Northerners come in that had, you know, came during the 70s or so on. And it was always Danny Hughes' shop to remember. You don't really remember the name of a shop ordinarily, but they remembered it and could tell me something that was terribly nice for me to gather, you know, some little story.
My memory of coming to Black Rock, and we walked out like coming from Hill Street, but was the, when I think of your dad, all I can think of as kids was the wee windmills that was outside. And now he must have sold a hell of a lot of them.
He sold a lot of windmills and buckets and spades, and so the morning was spent dressing that street, hanging things on hooks, and oh, it was horrendous. It was horrendous every morning, pulling it all out, and every evening pulling it all out. And then, of course, in the 80s then, he decided, he was always changing. And funny, I've changed the shop a lot recently. And when I think, when I'm about in my head to think, should I do it, I always think, what would Dad say? And he always changed. So I was always, I'd always let me.
For business, he thought changing, it was a
changed.
Good.
Yeah, because he had, in the 80s, he had a cafe, and you know, that was changing the place. And of course, there was millions of stories about the cafe. Jeepers, I couldn't. Like, for example, he sometimes merged the shop and the cafe. He didn't really see why they should be particularly separate. And above the chip pan, he used to always put in key rings. And he was notorious for loading far too much things into shelves. And things. I knew the key, key rings were forever falling into the chip pans. Well, the next thing is that someone would be served a Speedy Gonzales key ring or a Daffy Duck, and I can't illustrate it on the microphone here, but the nose would be all bent and with the hot grease, and the ear would be dripping down, and they'd come back and they'd say, "Was this toy is in my chips," and he'd say, "Well, that's the toy," which a Happy Meal, he'd say. They say, "You don't expect to cook the toy." So there was a million. Oh,
he always had an answer, hadn't he?
He always had an answer because of what he was getting away with, in a way. You know, you think of the lady that came in one time looking for St. Martin, and he said, "Come back in half an hour," and half an hour later he put boot polish on the infant of Prego, one of the others. If you're going to do that, you want to have your answers ready, you know. But he was always in bother, but the charm got him out of so much bother, like, because at one point he was felt really silly why people would want a variety of food. He says, "Sausage and chip is all anybody should want, so everything else we finish with fish and everything." So he only served sausage and chip, but he let them order away. They'd be ordering hamburgers and don't put gherkin on it, and side salad and a cheese, and then he'd hand them two sausage. It's unthinkable. He'd hand them two sausage and chip, and they'd say, "Excuse me, I think I have the wrong order," and he'd say, "No, you haven't. That's far better for you." And people's reaction then was, "Just eat it. We'll never come back." And then they'd be laughing their heads off. But just, people have changed so much. There's no way you'd manage that now. You know.
No, I was just going to say that you couldn't. He would never get away with any of this stuff he did.
No, it's inconceivable. But that was the norm, and I suppose for me, that was just the norm of a day, yeah. And the fun of a day, like the.
Were you conscious of him being that a character, shall we, for want of a better nice word about
yeah,
him?
Yeah, I was Harry, very much so, because there wasn't a dull day or there wasn't a dull moment with that man around you, because anything could kind of happen, you know, because he could do things that weren't ready to be done or shouldn't have been done, or he had it in his head and he'd just go and do them, you know, because he wasn't constrained by the things that we all are now. He wasn't constrained by people's opinion of him. He wasn't shy. He wasn't bothered. Wasn't bothered about all the things that crush us nowadays. He had none of them, and it wasn't in a hippie sort of way. It was just he didn't have them. It was because as a character, he was a dreamer. You know, some of his earliest working memories was when he had the house in Omeath, and he sold the vegetables in Dundalk, and it was a horse and cart, you know. So that journey over the hill, he'd go over the hill. That'd be the fastest way home. And I used to say, "Dad, how could you do it?" Because we often done the spin, and he'd tell me about it in the middle of winter. He said, "How could you do it? The cold and the slowness of the pony and so on." He said, "I wasn't on Omeath Hill," he says, "with the pony. I was with the Arabian Nights, or I was in a galleon hoisting up the mainsail," because he was a dreamer, and that's where his head was. And we've tons of pamphlets at home of all these stories of escapism stories. They're all escapism stories, and they're all them sort of things, Arabian Nights and so deserts.
How did your mum treat him?
Well, that was, you know, in a way, when you describe that and you didn't know me, mum, you'd think, how does any woman walk on that? Well, it was kind of good, because with a man like that, you need a steady anchor. And I guess that she knew that was her job, to anchor the whole thing down, to make sure it worked. And then, because that was happening, he could kind of be Danny Hughes. And she allowed him to be, because he was a loving husband.
It's when you think of him, there was so many people around his age group, like growing up, characters. I keep using that word, but you know what I mean. They're badly missed, aren't they?
They are badly missed, and in a funny way, people nowadays are still characters, but they quell that part of themselves to conform, whereas them, in a way, you didn't. There was no conform them days. You were, it was kind of survival was the thing, and you your character made you survive. But nowadays, people want, they want to be loose from Breakout, but they're a bit tethered.
Was he into sport in any way at all?
No. You know, you have this sport and you have music and things, but sport never was a thing for me. I guess because as a young boy, he was walking very quickly, so he didn't have time for sport. Yeah.
Would you think back, Conor, that he had a good life? Like, you know, you are, there's a wee rub off of you, I suppose, yeah, on him, you know. And so, like, would you be picking up things that he used to do or anything like that?
Yeah, you think you don't, and then in retrospect, you look at something you've done, you think, jeepers, that's exactly what I thought I'd never do or what he used to do. But I picked up great things from definitely, I suppose the main thing is knowing what's important. There's loads of stuff happening to us every day and you get all caught up in it and all upset by it. And then I've learned to sort of, at some point in the day, not necessarily at a set point, look at it all again and say, wait a minute, what the hell am I at here? This is ridiculous. None of that matters that much. Let's just calm down, stop putting people under pressure.
You had to be getting that from your dad.
For sure. Yeah, he was always saying, Conor, none of these things matter. There's the real stuff there.
Now, Conor, one of the big things we can't go through any further without talking about is poems.
Yeah, the poems. It was extraordinary the amount of time he spent writing. You know, it was, he had a lovely routine. He wasn't really a television man. In the evening, he might dig in the garden or so. He'd never stop. You know, there was no stopping. The machine would change shape, but it'd never stop. So he'd write for an hour or two. He played a fiddle for an hour or two, and then get ready to get up early in the next morning. But it's all from that romantic aspect of his vision of life that his poems
because
and
he
his
did story. Publish a few books, didn't he?
Yeah, I guess he enjoyed that. You know, lots of people write stories and write poems, but Dad once again made sure they got published, and he done it himself, of course, you know. But that is what he does. He makes the thing happen. He's good at making a thing happen. And sir, even when he'd run out, if I remember, one of them has a cover of Beautiful Ireland, and it's a lake in Canada, like sort of. But he sold away at it, and then of course Harry, I could give you an hour on every time each book. I try and shorten the story. Each book had a core story of something that happened in Blackrock, because he was mad to bring visitors to Blackrock. You know, he often talked about how he'd leave a trail of bread for Fungi the dolphin and bring him right round the coast into our bay. You know, so this is, he always wanted something, shipwrecks or something. So in the stories, he would make up these stories, and it would have happened in the stories that happened in Blackrock. You know, so to back up the story, before the book would come out, him and I would have to go and do something. For example, there's a cross round towards the boathouse there that him and I put in the rocks one day, and I remember him specifically writing 1693 in the wet cement. And then another time there was stories about witches, and we were born on grass and spreading rumours about the witches. Another time there was stories about how the medicinal quality of the water around by the boathouse, and people were going around on crutches and everything. He had them. By his encouragement, you know, so he was always up to messing.
Well, you picked up a lot of that kind of stuff when you do your St. Stephen's Day.
I suppose to. That's the character I've come from. It's what I was reared with, you know, a bit of devilment and a bit of...
You probably thought it was the norm, nearly.
Somewhat, but I did know the other kids weren't going round at midnight... putting crosses.
Did you think he was different than their dads?
Oh, I knew it. Yeah, gosh, there was no comparison. Their dads were equally as fine men, but definitely the word eccentric would have to be labelled on my father. Yeah.
When Conor later on, he was, the shop had changed quite a bit over the years, you know, but he still maintained the personal touch. He never lost that ever until he got ill. And tell me a little bit about how that creeped up on him, Conor.
the transition of the shop.
Well, I
when I kind of came of age, we business wasn't enough for the two of us, you know, and I was away doing other jobs, nothing at all creative. And then I had a hankering to be back with him, you know, to be in the shop with him.
Did you miss him?
I guess I only knew I missed him when I got back into the shop. I remember thinking, jeepers, I was away working in hotels or whatever, and I think, jeepers, what was I doing that when I could have been here? But I was quick enough to learn that, so we had quite a span of time together in the shop together. So we started the musical instruments because I thought it'd be a good business thing, and it worked out real fine, and little by little.
And did he accept that, Conor?
Very much so, very much so, because he knew... Oh gosh, it was father and son together. I'm not really sure a father could ask.
He's delighted to see you coming back into the business.
I think a father loves his son or his daughter with him. I think it can only be. I could only imagine. So we had fantastic all them years together, and a huge body of years together as the shop changed.
When, Conor, was it difficult for him eventually to have to give up the shop that he wasn't able to? Was that a prolonged thing, or
interesting enough? No, and you hear that that's a dreadful thing for men, but no, it happened terribly natural, as if it wasn't happening, if you know what I mean. It was so slow, and maybe we'd scale him down a bit, and then we urged him to close at 6. We used to go on, you know, so everything was very tempered and slow and at our ease. So by no means, because in the end of the day it was still our shop together, and Danny Hughes's was on top.
When he would come back to the shop though, not full time kind of thing, mm-hmm. was that a sad time for you, looking at him, what was happening, or was he just happy to get in on those days and you just enjoyed his company?
It was for him not sad, but for me sad, because I knew we were kind of in the autumn of a relationship, and someday he wouldn't be with me. So that was somewhat poignant, but not something I'd dwell on. I was aware of it, but I wouldn't dwell on it. And then for himself, he was, I guess physically he was happy to, it was 93 when he passed away, so physically he was happy to get down.
I remember, Conor, when he wasn't well, that we had a little radio station upstairs in one of your rooms.
Oh, yeah.
And my memory of your dad was you would take him in for a few hours and then leave him home. But it was absolutely lovely to see him when he would be there, and he just walked out and he'd be, put the windmills and stuff that was out there, he'd moved them around and twisted as if he was there. That was a lovely thought, though.
The thing was, you couldn't bring him down to sit down. He wouldn't sit down. He was always footering with the stuff and trying to tidy it. You know, it was just this inbuilt battery that never stops. Yeah. He didn't have this idleness about him or relaxing time. His relaxing time was when he was in his shop, in his...
How would he, if he came back now, how would he think with the bistro next door here and the changes in the shop here? How do you think he would...
I can only guess, but knowing him as intricate as I do, I think he'd absolutely love seeing the building alive, because every inch of this building upstairs, to the left, to the right, is alive. There's someone walking, and the ethos of what he created is still there. It's in the cafe, they're friendly in the cafe, they're nice, and the shop here, we still have time for people and so on. So we've kept what Danny Hughes created from nothing, and his name's still on the shop. And I purposely called it, when I kind of renamed the brand as such, everything's branding now, I call it the Promenade at Danny Hughes's. And that's because 41 years ago, as you say, he was at the beginning of the interview, you said he was a man of vision. 41 years ago, he had a vision for a promenade in Blackrock, and he went to quite an extensive trouble to make a good. It wasn't just a concept. He went to the man who drew it for Bray, and he drew it for Blackrock, and he was at the British Embassy. He was about half a craft business coming in, and he went to a lot, so he never got that.
So weren't that close?
Well, it went that close on his walk side, but I remember in particular 41 years ago the heading of the Argus, which should have been talking about the plan, but they were quite opinionated because they said local businessman pie in the sky, so it was quite, that was their opinion anyway. Anyway, so be it. But that was the, that. So in a way he was close but not close. Yeah.
Had he other ideas for Blackrock? Like, his whole life was about Blackrock, wasn't it?
Yeah, that one lasted a long time. He was years pushing that plan. And
did it upset him then when it all fell through?
He was disappointed. Yeah, I suppose upset's the same word as disappointed. But it wouldn't have manifested in him in any way, you know, so, on his daily thing. But he was disappointed that the village wasn't interested in embracing a vision. And it was a well thought out plan. It wasn't, I also remember all the trouble in the village. It was chaos. It was war at some of the public meetings. And
some people wanted it and some people didn't.
Well, in general, the locals didn't want it. It was nearly all of them, you know, it was that we were turning the place into a Las Vegas. And I remember all them sentences, you know. So.
Well, he has his promenade out the front exactly now. You put it up for him and say, lovely tie in now, that car.
Yeah, it was a little thing, I guess. Only me, now your listeners will understand why I called it that, yeah. But it was something, yeah.
Conor, when did your mum pass away?
Well, I was 17 years previous to Dad passing away, approximately.
So. Was that a big, sad time in his life, and did he find it difficult without her?
The good thing was, all my life I lived at home. We had kind of an unusual relationship that, you know, I lived with my parents and continued living with my father, so he was never left on his own, you know, and we did all we could for mum when she was troubled and ill. We were always there.
Was she a Dundalk lady or?
No, she came from Ballybay, Monaghan, yeah, and came here on holidays and seen him going up in the horse and cart and talked to him. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, they came here and, you know, that's a lot of people from Monaghan came here and.
That's a lovely romantic side.
It's a really nice one, yeah. And so that's how they met. Yeah. And,
people will always remember Danny, and for their different ways.
Yeah.
But you were very, very close to him. And how would you describe his life? That he lived a life, I suppose, that a lot of people would love to live, but hadn't the guts, but the power or whatever to do it. How would you describe his life?
Yeah, that's interesting how you put that, because that life's there for most people to take, not everybody, because circumstances don't work good for a lot of people. But he decided that he could have that life, and that was a life based on who he was as a character, not who people wanted him to be. If I had to simplify it, that's what it was. His own character flourished. He wasn't curtailed by convention, society. None of them things curtailed him. And they never would have had a chance to try. And I guess that's why it was a life worth living.
Conor, can I thank you very much indeed?
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking about him.
Listen to lots more epic interviews at GatheringHeritage.com.